it's a pleasure to be with you all this evening. I'm going to try and address this title, but feel free to ask any questions either during the talk or afterwards. Just as by way of background, I worked for IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, for 31 years, and which is the intergovernmental body that oversees conservation outside of the United Nations system and is responsible for providing a lot of the scientific knowledge products that guide conservation worldwide. So I'll talk a bit about that. So my career has been as a scientist within that, but also very much as a sort of politician negotiator as well, because that's what one has to do in the international sphere. And now, when I completed my time at IUCN, because it's under term limits, I've been working for a donor called Synchronicity Earth, and I'm also a trustee of a Russia International, which is really the leading Christian conservation organization that works on the ground in more than 20 countries around the world. My talk is about science, not about my Christian faith, but actually I'm a Christian and I attend and am a member of Holy Trinity Church in Coombe Down on the south side of Bath. Some of you in Bristol might have heard of us, there were a little provincial city of Bath. I just thought I'd put up this quote here from 1 Kings about Solomon, which I think is perhaps, we could take perhaps theologically as a, would be, I guess, our mandate as biologists to try and understand the life on Earth. Look what Solomon did. He was a king, but he also looked at the little things like the hyssop that grows out of the walls. I think that's fantastic. Anyway, that's just a little bit of a background as to what I think my faith-based mandate is. But I want to take us back to 2009, when the then chief scientist of the UK government, Sir John Beddington, published a paper. It wasn't a peer-reviewed paper, it was a government policy paper called The Perfect Storm. And Beddington said, and it's been sort of corroborated by many other studies, that we basically faced 4 major global challenges that are coming together to around the same time to cause a perfect storm. A crisis the like of which the world has not seen before, and so we had better, because we have warning, get our act together to deal with it. And those crises are, of course, climate change, which is by far the best publicized, energy, food, so huge increase in food demand, for instance, and water. So these demands going on and huge increases in them are what's driving the unsustainability and fragility of our planet. WWF and the Zoological Society of London published the Living Planet report that comes out every 2 years. About a week ago, maybe 10 days ago. I'm sorry, that's not very clear, but the point I want to make here is these are a load of socioeconomic trends like world population, global GDP, urban population, goodness, it's hard to read some of them, large dams, transportation, etc. And for many of these things, around about 1950, thereabouts, you get a sudden inflection. Slow growth, and then from 1950 onwards, very rapid growth. And so during the lifetimes of many of us in this room, the world has suddenly started going through very radical change that has continued to this day. And you see the same with Earth system trends. There's carbon dioxide, the top left one, nitrogen dioxide, methane, but also global fisheries. A number of measures like this of Earth system trends also showed a major change around 1950. And so before 1950, we were much less worried, and to some extent didn't even know about some of these problems. We hardly knew about CO2 as a problem. We certainly didn't think we could overfish the oceans, for example. Now we know all that's happened. And it's relatively recent in human history that we've come to understand this. And it's because our impact as humans on the planet, when it started to go through massive transformation from about 1950 onwards. This diagram here has been much used in public policy since around 2009. It comes from a paper by Johan Rockström and his colleagues from the Stockholm Resilience Centre, published in Nature 2009. And the paper is called A Safe Operating Space for Humanity. And in that, Rockström and his colleagues postulate for the first time the concept of planetary boundaries. And so around this globe, you'll see various planetary boundaries. Climate change at the top, ocean acidification, stratospheric ozone depletion, active nitrogen deposition, phosphorus deposition, global freshwater use, change in land use, biodiversity change, etc. And in 2009, what Rockström did is they tried to work out what they thought was a safe boundary that we shouldn't cross, and that's the green circle in the middle. And they felt that on three of them, at that time in 2009, we had already crossed the boundary based on the evidence they could gather from multiple sources. And it was a postulation, because of course it wasn't known for sure whether they were right or wrong in all of these, but they were putting it out as the first contribution to a debate that has continued ever since. And they claim that on climate change, nitrogen deposition, and biodiversity loss of species and ecosystems, we had already crossed the planetary boundaries. And in the case of the one I work on, biodiversity loss, down in the bottom left, we'd massively crossed them. Since then, it's been felt that we have crossed other boundaries as well. So those are some, that's the same diagram, but just shown a little, maybe slightly more clearly. There the black polygon in the middle, a black edged polygon is equivalent to the green, you know, those are the planetary boundaries that are being postulated. And the notion of planetary boundaries has become a sort of scientific concept that has been extremely important in intergovernmental negotiations and policy development ever since, in the Climate Change Convention and in the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is the convention that the international treaty that governs biodiversity, nature, and ecosystems. So this paper had a huge impact and continues to this day. Now, that's just a little bit of context, because I'm supposed to be talking about species. But I might just also say that there are many reasons why we care about nature. And as Christians, we have theological reasons, which I believe that Hilary Marlowe spoke to you about quite a bit, what, a couple of months ago or something?
More than that, about 9 months ago.
Whenever she spoke. Good person to listen to. If you haven't heard Hilary's talk, get it off the website. But nature is a home to biodiversity. Nature is our source of, ultimately, for food, shelter, and medicines. Nature provides us clean water, air, and healthy soils, and nature inspires us. And around this is the idea of ecosystem services, that nature provides services not only to humanity, but to all of life on Earth. And these ecosystem services get divided into cultural services such as spiritual and religious values or aesthetic values, provisioning services such as raw materials, food, medicines, regulating services such as water regulation, carbon regulation, all those sorts of things, and supporting regulations like photosynthesis, nutrient cycling, many others. You can find this on the Living Planet report of WWF and ZSL, which is freely available online, came out, as I said, last week. Now, another way of looking at it, creative people have come up with clever ways of trying to look at this massive global problem of unsustainability and the way we're living, and tried to come up with ways of expressing it to try and drive the message home. This one comes from the Global Footprint Network. And what the Global Footprint Network does is it does several things, but in this particular diagram for 2018, it gives the date and the year when each country exceeded its limit in terms of taking its share of nature that year sustainably, which is ultimately comes down to photosynthesis. And you know, did we take more than we should have done? And so Qatar exceeded its limits in February the 9th and Vietnam on December the 21st, the UK on May the 8th. So to keep, if we all, another way of saying this is if we all lived, if the whole world lived like we British people did, we would need 2.5 Earths to support us. And so that's the message it's trying to drive home. This is something else for the Global Footprint Network did a while ago now, but this just shows the sort of demands that each country is placing on the planet. And every time you see a country that is greatly expanded beyond the boundaries that we expect, that country is living beyond its ecological means. So the United States, of course, the Western European countries, look at Germany, UK, France, but also countries like Japan, South Korea, China and India, where they have huge populations, are borrowing from the planet. And in the end, we're taking it off equatorial Africa and South America. And you see a few countries that are more or less balanced because their coastlines look like we expect them to, like Indonesia, for example. So that's another way in which the Global Footprint Network, and you can go online and you can read all the scientific methodology behind this, but it's a way of trying to understand how our lifestyles and our economies are borrowing from the planet, borrowing from the capital, if you like, the natural capital that the world has. So I've been asked to talk about species. So what does this mean for species? Well, in the end, all of this, because we're living as we are, all of this borrows off the species diversity of the planet. So this particular diagram comes from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was a global scientific assessment that reported in 2005. I was privileged to be part of that. What this shows is on the left-hand side, from the fossil record, you can see the extinction rate. Then we have in the green recent past extinctions and the future modeled extinctions. And essentially, what this is telling us is already we've driven extinction rates up to close to 1,000 times the background rate, the natural rate of extinction. And we look set to put that up another order of magnitude if we're not very careful. And this has resulted in some very high percentages of species groups now being at risk of extinction. Now, in the global policy world, we try and pull together all the data sets that exist, and there's massive uncertainty around the data on species and ecosystems globally, as you might imagine. Very hard to measure. To try and come up with indicators to inform policy making and decision making. So this was a paper that was published in Sciences on Global Biodiversity Indicators of Recent Declines. It was led by Stuart Butchart, he was the first author, and basically took together all the indicators. I was a co-author on this, and we took together all the indicators we could find and grouped them. And we had to get clever statisticians to tell us how we could legitimately group them and make into a way that was meaningful. And we grouped the indicators into state, pressure, and response. The state of biodiversity, the state of nature. Is it getting better or worse? Pressure is the pressure on nature, the threats, if you like. And the response is our response to those threats. And this was done for 2010. when the last big negotiations on biodiversity took place among the governments to agree the conservation targets for the world. And the graph on response, graph C, showing the levelling off in response. In other words, we weren't doing more to address rapidly increasing pressures. That graph in particular was very important in coming up with a new strategic plan for biodiversity for the world, which was much more ambitious than anyone expected. Those are the actually biodiversity targets. Unfortunately, we haven't implemented them, but that's a different matter, which we can talk about if you want. Now, the various different ways in which we measure what's going on in the world. This is one that gets a lot of publicity. This is the Living Planet Index, which WWF do. It's basically, they take populations of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish, and they monitor them over time, and you've seen a continuous decrease. There are arguments, to be honest, about the methodologies here. And probably this can't be pushed too far, but I think it represents a general truth that the huge declines at the population level in all these species groups. The main problem, the main scientific question about it is whether the species that are being monitored are representative of changes going on. Statistically, probably not, but as a general principle, is not telling a story that is likely to be false. But actually, the way in which the status of and trends of the world's species are actually monitored much more consistently and thoroughly is not through the Living Planet Index, but through the IUCN Red List. So the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species is the official listing that is carried out under IUCN, the organization for which I used to work and which I'm still heavily associated with. And we run the independent peer review and expert and data gathering mechanisms to run the red list. So I'll tell you a little bit about this, because an awful lot of what we know about the status and trends of species comes from the red list. So the red list is a bit like a hospital. So you can come into the emergency room, or A&E, we call it in this country, don't we? You can have walking, breathing, and you've got all these criteria there on the left, right? And then we end up in categories. Based on these criteria, we end up in categories. Priority delay, priority three delay, dead. Priority one immediate, etc. So criteria are used based on common sense things like breathing and circulation and whatever to put people quickly into categories that then affect what we do. So the red list does the same. It's got criteria and categories. So these five criteria were developed over a long period of time using extinction risk biology to come up with means of categorizing species according to their level of extinction risk. And so the criteria on the left there, population reduction, restricted geographic range, small populations, etc. And you can use these criteria at all sorts of quantitative thresholds. They're quite complicated. And you can blame me because I was one of the people who was involved in developing all of this. And they're used to put every species in the world into a category. And those categories range from extinct in the wild, through to the three threatened categories, which are critically endangered, and vulnerable. Then we have near threatened, least concerned. And then we have a couple of categories off to the side. We have data deficient, where we just don't know enough about it. There are many species for which we have a name, but we don't really know what the species is. So that has to go into the data deficient. And then we have not evaluated at the bottom, which means we haven't put that species through the system yet. So that is what is done on the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. And you can go online and you can see it all. So it's the most comprehensive information source on species that you can find. It's not just a list, it's called a red list, but it's not actually a list. It's got a massive amount of information in there behind each species. It's peer-reviewed and it's widely used to inform a huge amount of decision-making by governments, by corporations, by conservation organizations. So it's extremely heavily used. And it includes all sorts of information, such as on not just on the level of threat, which is what those categories are, the sort of extinction risk, but also on the type of threat, the ecological requirements, the distribution maps, all sorts of things are there. But the categories are according to the extinction risk, and not according to conservation priority. It's things that every species is categorized according to its extinction risk. There are other factors that people might choose for according conservation priority to a species. Might be that it's a species of great cultural resonance to a particular country, or it might have high economic value, or it might be low priority because it's ugly, or no one knows much about it, or whatever. So the red list categorizes species not to, according to conservation priority, but to extinction risk. Now, just a little bit about what's in the red list. So we have about 1.8, actually the slide is slightly out of data. It's more like 1.9 million species described at the moment. We don't know how many species exist in the world. Some people say it's 10 to 100 million. Some people say it's 8 to 15 million is a lot. It's many more than we have described. And in particular, we don't really know how to do taxonomy, the naming of species in certain taxonomic groups, and what are real boundaries between one species and another. That's especially true of fungi. And so really, the number of fungal species is probably hugely underestimated and could have a huge impact on what those numbers are. And we have even less idea about how to talk about species concepts in microorganisms. So huge uncertainties about the number of species, but we have scientific names for 1.9 million. And on the red list, we have assessed, as of 2 days ago, when the last update happened, 96,936 species. Which are about 5% of the total. And of those 96,900, nearly 27,000 fall in those threatened categories of critically endangered, and vulnerable. I showed you just a moment ago. And 941 are extinct or extinct in the wild. So extinct in the wild means it's in a zoo or botanic garden, but not in the wild. So that gives you an idea. Now, we're not going to, and no one is going to try, and take all 1.9 million or 100 million or however many species there are and put it through the IUCN red list system. That would frankly be a waste of time. It would cost a lot of money and for little benefit. And so IUCN has an approach to try and get the number of species on the red list to about 160,000. And they've gone through a whole process to figure out how to come up with a sample of species that is broadly representative of biodiversity, and it's felt to do that we need to be monitoring about 160,000 species. Remember, these are animals, plants, fungi, and other groups like seaweeds and things. So that gives you a rough idea of what's in there. Now, this horrible graph, really, isn't it? But this is just showing you different threat levels across groups, because different taxonomic groups are very varied in their levels of threat. And the more green on there, the less threatened it is, and the more black, red, orange, and yellow, the less threatened. The more threatened it is. So green is the category least concerned. Red is the category critically endangered, on the edge of extinction. Black is extinct. And so you really don't want reds, oranges, or yellows. So these are just arranged in order from the least to the most threatened groups. So fish at the top, least threatened, but that is radically different if you take freshwater fish out from marine fish, because freshwater fish are much more threatened than marine. Haven't done that in this diagram. You go all the way down to the really, really threatened groups. At the bottom, we have amphibians, one up from the top. which is my speciality, and cycads, which are these sort of dinosaurs of the plant world. And these are the most threatened groups we've looked at. But within any one of these groups, you can find families or orders that are more or less threatened. For instance, among the fish, the sturgeon are extremely threatened group among the fish, for example. And this is just showing you some of the information you can get off the register if you're so inclined. So, for example, here's a map showing the global distribution of threatened mammals. So the more bright red it is, the more threatened mammals there are terrestrially, and the more dark blue, the more threatened mammals there are in the marine ecosystems. You can also get maps to show different levels of the most important threats for different groups of species. So that graph, for example, looks at the amphibians and shows you the different types of threat. Some are much more important than others. And this graph here shows you the major habitat preferences for birds, for example. So this is all stuff you can put on the list, so you can understand why many, many students are doing their undergraduate thesis on these sorts of data, because I think it's in the public domain, they can pull them off and use them. This is just the sort of thing we can now say. So looking at the freshwater fishes assessed so far, pollution is affecting 33% of them, harvesting, so overfishing, 22% of them, dams, 21%, and invasive species, 10%. So that's the sort of thing we now know, but really 10 years ago we didn't know. We know this now for lots of groups, and this is because in the last 10 years, we've seen a massive increase in the number of assessments of species, and that's continuing to accelerate as IUCN tries to get up to that target of 160,000 species. And then we can look at threat patterns. So top left is patterns of bird species, threatened species richness. Top right is mammals. Bottom left is amphibians, bottom right is corals. Corals, of course, only in the sea, and amphibians never in the sea. So this shows that actually the patterns are fairly different between the different groups. And that's one reason why it's necessary to look at a number of taxonomic groups, because many taxonomic groups are not good indicators of other groups. And so in coming up with that number of 160,000 that IUCN wishes to get to, is trying to add on taxonomic groups to be assessed, that it is believed, the experts believe, will add new information about types of threat, patterns of threat. So we don't want to spend a lot of money assessing species groups that will just have the same pattern, for instance, as birds or mammals, because we already need to know, we already know where to do conservation for birds and mammals, and so if anything has the same pattern as that, then we should pick up those species in conservation measures. But we need to look at taxonomic groups that have different patterns. I want to point out the amphibian map, because probably sitting back there, it looks like there are almost no threatened species. There you can hardly see any reds on the amphibian map, bottom left one. And yet, amphibians are actually the most threatened group of all of these four. And the reason for that is they're concentrated in tiny places along the northern Andes, along the southern part of Central America, in East Africa, in Cameroon, on the Western Ghats of India, in a few places of the world, all the threatened amphibians pack in. So really very different from the other groups, for example. Now, the red list also tracks change of species over time. It's not doing this for anything like all the taxonomic groups at the moment, but these are ones that it is doing. So this shows the steepest line there at the top is the corals, and you've seen the rapid decline in corals. I'm going to come back to that because that's one of the major global issues. Very gentle line near the top is birds, then mammals, and amphibians, and the cycads down at the bottom. We've just finished the conifers actually, but I can't find a figure at the moment where the conifers are, and I can't remember where they go. The blue line is putting them all together and doing some modelling, and the grey you might see around it are is the error margins. So that's the red list index, so it shows the trends over time, and it can be calculated for any group of species, providing they've been assessed more than once. And it's based on the proportion of species that are threatened and changing status due to genuine reasons. When we assess species, we often find new knowledge and change a reddish category because we discover a new population we didn't know existed before, or we find that species is actually two species, not one species, and so changes are made. None of that is allowed to go into the red list index. It's genuine change in status. It got closer to extinction or further from extinction. So that's what drives it. So every red list index you look at is going down. So that's just to cheer you all up. So that's a problem, isn't it? It's not surprising, though, when I showed you the big global trends earlier on. But having said this, we know that targeted conservation works. Now, we know this in sort of little details. So we looked at recent genuine improvements in the status of mammals, for instance. About 37 of them were due to conservation action. We find that 5% of threatened mammals have increasing populations. That's good news. The bird people prevented 16 bird species from going extinct over a 15-year period. That's pretty impressive. And without conservation action, the red list index for birds and mammals would have been 20% worse. So it was, although conservation was not preventing a deterioration of the overall status of these groups of species, if it hadn't taken place, things would have been worse. It was about 4 years ago, some colleagues and I published this paper in the Journal of Conservation Biology, where we looked at the red list index for the world's ungulates, you know, deer, cattle, goats, sheep, this sort of thing. And this here shows the observed red list index going down for the world's ungulates between 1996 and 2008. And then we conducted a thought experiment. We did a counterfactual, if you like, where we looked at what would have happened if we had stopped conservation at the beginning of the measuring period, 1996. So we had to construct a whole load of rules. The editors of the journal made us do that, otherwise we couldn't prove a consistent methodology to say what we did in particular situations. But basically what we're saying is, in 1996, we'll stop all protected areas, we'll stop all hunting controls, we'll stop all wildlife trade controls, we'll stop all conservation education, we'll close down all the zoos. Sorry about that, Crystal Zoo's gone. All of that. We'll do all of that, and then what would have happened to those species? And following the rules that we constructed, which our referees and our editors decided were reasonable rules, that's what would have happened. In other words, the counterfactual red list index was 7 or 8 times worse. There were various factors that affected whether it was worse or not. Did you count trophy hunting of antelope in South Africa as conservation or not? Some people say yes, some people say no. Controversial. So we just did it under two scenarios. Put that complication in here. But the bottom line is, conservation was having the effect of conservation is the difference between those two lines. So conservation on the one hand wasn't working, because a black line is still going down, but in another sense was having a huge impact. There's an organization you may have heard of, the Durrell Wildlife Conservation Trust. Have you heard of Gerald Durrell?
Yeah.
I think more of an age know Gerald Durrell. And he founded the Jersey Zoo, which is now called the Durrell Wildlife Conservation Trust. Their field conservation and science office is actually in Bath, and I share offices with them. And they have constructed the Durrell Index. So they've taken all the species they've worked on over the last nearly 30 years, and they did exactly the same as we did for the ungulates. They calculated the counterfactual. That actually is the counterfactual, the red line, because this is what actually happened. Because they worked on these species, they actually drove a line up which is still the only line we have going up on the red list index. And so that tells us one thing, that Dunwall were doing something right, still doing something right. And so it started to be used as a tool for organisational performance, as well as just measuring globally what's going on out in the world. So the reason for going through that stuff is, although we conservation is fighting against a moving target, and we're not getting the success we need, it's not like conservation is having no impact, it's actually having a very big impact, even at the global level. It's just not having enough impact. The way I put it when people ask me, and when I get aggressive journalists talking to me, why waste time on this because it doesn't work, and the answer we give is, well, it does work, we just don't do enough of it. The problem with that answer is it isn't really true. It is true up to a point. But there are some problems that we can't easily fix. So I'm going to just walk us through a few issues here. Some issues we can't easily fix because of lack of political will. There are other issues that we can't easily fix because we don't know how to fix them. Okay, so over-harvesting, we do actually know, and over-fishing, we do actually know what to do about it. We just reduce fishing pressure, right? It's quite clear what to do. The fact is we don't do it. This graph here shows you fishing pressure. It's from the Living Planet report from last week, by the way. Fishing pressure in 1950, top map, versus 2000, bottom map. And you'll see, going from cold to warm colours, you'll see a huge increase in fishing pressure, especially in the Pacific. And of course, that's driven from China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan. And so a huge proportion of fisheries are now overfished. In principle, we know what to do. In practice, we don't do it yet. And that's going to become a major challenge. You hear about similar problems with terrestrial species. I'm sure you all heard about recent elephant and rhino declines due to the illegal wildlife trade, things like this. Again, we know perfectly well what to do, and actually there is some local success for some of those species, or even complete success, like the Indian rhino, for example, which is increasing due to protection. But by and large, we're not getting a grip of over-harvesting of species. So that's what I call a problem of lack of political will. Here's another one, dams. We think that because we tend to look at climate change as the overriding conservation issue at the moment, we tend to think of dams as green. If you want to take home one message from here tonight, dams are not green. Okay, dams are not green. Dams are a major cause of species loss and extinction. And the reason is they disrupt the ecosystems and the flow of rivers, both upstream and downstream, with huge impacts. And we're still not planning dams properly, putting them in the right places, putting the mitigation measures in to allow migrations to continue, to ensure that habitats aren't completely lost. A lot more could be done, but a long way off it. This is a tragic photo. This is a Chinese giant panfish. It's the longest freshwater fish in the world. It's probably now extinct because of the Three Gorges Dam separated off its sort of wintering area from its breeding area. It's essentially gone. It will have gone. They're none in captivity. So those are two major threats for which we so far do not have the political will to solve them. Those are actually fairly obvious what to do in both those cases. Now I'm going to go on to a set of threats that are much more difficult to deal with, and for which research is still the key thing to do. Amphibian extinctions. So amphibians worldwide have been devastated by a fungal disease called chytridiomycosis since it was first detected in Yosemite National Park in about 1970, yes, in fact it was 1970, and has we have no cure for this disease in the wild. We probably have at least 100 species that have gone extinct, and many hundreds that are surviving in tiny populations or can't yet be found but might not be extinct. Complicated. This here is a gastric brooding frog. There are two species of gastric brooding frog in Australia. They both disappeared very suddenly, one in the late 70s, the other in the early 80s. These frogs were the only frogs that reared their young in their stomachs. So they reared their eggs and the larvae all in the stomach acid, and then they came out of the mouth. So there it is, a little baby about to come out of the outside world. Anyway, they're both extinct, both species of gastric brooding frog. And many other examples.
What's the origin of this disease?
There are two main diseases, but probably one is very, very bad in frogs, and that probably comes from Korea. It's the latest thing. For a long time it was thought that it came from Africa, but it probably came from Korea. But it might well have been moved around the world by the xenopus, the clawed toads, of whom the world expert on xenopus is Richard Tinsley, who's the emeritus now at the zoology department in Bristol. But xenopus were moved around the world from the 1930s to be used in pregnancy tests in women, because I think if you injected a female xenopus with the urine of a pregnant woman, it would lay eggs. Those were the original pregnancy tests. And so xenopus have gone worldwide, and they've escaped. Once they escaped, they're very hard to find. In fact, you've come from Chester, haven't you? In South Wales, there are xenopus living in the wild. So probably somehow the disease got from Korea into African xenopus somehow, and then went worldwide. It's also gotten to American bullfrogs that have also gone worldwide, and probably the European marsh frogs as well, which is invasive in this area. I don't know, 15 years ago there were no marsh frogs in the Somerset levels. Now there are untold tens, hundreds of thousands of them. So these are all carrier species, and they've spread this disease around to naive species around the world. There's another disease which affects salamanders only, and that comes from China. That one we know comes from China, and it is currently causing a major epidemic in Germany, Netherlands, and Belgium. And it seems that, with one exception, the European palmate ute, all other European salamanders have no immune response whatsoever to this disease. So if that gets into the UK, then we'll lose two of our new species. Unless we can come up with solutions to this disease. So there's an awful lot of research going on this at the moment, including in some areas where some conservationists are very uncomfortable, like using genetic techniques to see if we can engineer forms of resistance or whatever in amphibians. So if you're anti-GMO, that's a problem for you. Anyway, I'm using amphibians here because they're an example of a novel infectious disease. And there are a number that have been cropping up in recent years. There's a huge decline of cave-dwelling bats in North America due to another fungal disease called white nose syndrome. And it's causing catastrophic decline of American bats, for example. There's another infectious disease that's in danger of wiping out a marsupial called the Tasmanian devil on Tasmania. And other examples going on, there's coral disease. They've now got snake disease in the UK, all sorts of things, new diseases, and very often there's no immune response to them, which in the end means extinction. So we have to come up with new techniques, and right now we are, I guess we have two strategies. One is to research practical techniques in the wild, and the other is to manage species ex situ in captivity, until we can come up with a solution. So in Bristol Zoo you have a biosecure amphibian breeding lab, don't you? Which is absolutely not possible for the public to go into, where a number of susceptible species have been bred, for example. And you'll find that all over the world now. Sorry, it took a little while on that one. Perhaps one of the most serious crises is the coral reef crisis, and the fact that corals really need CO2 levels less than 350 parts per million, and are well over 400 now. And there have been a number of papers on this, and ocean acidification leads to bleaching of corals, so you go from healthy to bleached, caused by corals expelling the algae, the zooxanthellae algae that are symbiotic in their tissues. They expel them at higher temperatures, and that leads to the bleaching of the corals. And bleaching events become more and more frequent with climate change. So as you can imagine, that's a massive problem. Again, all sorts of discussions about it. Amazingly, corals evolve fast. So corals, for instance, start laying, start doing all sorts of things to respond to these pressures. But can they do it at the speed required? It's not clear. It's not clear. And there will be limits, of course, as to what they can evolve to. There are other problems related to climate change, for instance, the loss of summer sea ice. So this is the ringed seal. The ringed seal is an abundant species, one of a species that no one would ever have considered to be threatened. The problem with the ringed seal and a number of other seal species in both the Arctic and the Antarctic is they have to breed on ice. They cannot breed on land, and they can't breed in the water, obviously. And the reasons why they have to breed on ice, but with the loss of summer sea ice, this species, abundant species, is in the next few decades going to lose its entire breeding habitat. Related to this is ocean acidification, which is obviously climate change raises ocean surface temperatures. It also increases. That makes the pH fall, in other words, makes oceans more acid. And corals, unlike other calcifying organisms in the oceans, at least reef-building corals, their carbon exoskeletons are made of aragonite rather than calcite, and aragonite is more susceptible to acidification. So if you look at this graph, you can see how over the, this is in tens of millions of years, you see the sudden drop in pH in the oceans going on, including projective, I should say. And looking at projective, what they call the aragonite saturation state, probably we've got some chemists or physicists here who will understand this more than me, because it's not my speciality. But basically, what they're saying is the red areas of the ocean will be too acid for corals. Many of those anyway are too temperate. The sort of yellowish is marginal, the green, which hardly exists, is adequate. Nothing is optimal. So, and the black dots are where coral reefs actually are. So so that is a troubling graph, a map to say the least. And acidification also affects how fish, such as the clownfish, Nemo here, how they home in on and live with the sea anemones on the reefs, and they can lose their homing ability with their sea anemones. So we have a whole set of threats related to CO2 levels, acidification, climate change, and all of that, which is obviously something that the world is going to have to address. The recent report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said we have 12 years really now to get our act together, much faster than Beddington said back in 2009. And probably the only way we can deal with that is to use multiple approaches to get CO2 levels down. There won't be a single one. Acidification also affects terrestrial species. And this is, there have been examples in the UK of fungi such as chanderelles curtain fungus and this sort of thing, and you see how the abundance of some of these species really dropped off during the 1970s. Now that was partly acid rain related, it's not just CO2 related, so you can see a little bit of recovery on the right there. But acidification is a sort of ecosystem-wide phenomenon. Another climate change issue is affecting migratory species. So migratory birds are arriving earlier than before, and often no longer in sync with the various food sources and things like that. And so we've seen huge declines in migratory species. Now, I have to say, for some of these, climate change won't be the only cause of the decline. The turtle dove on the top left there, which is probably a bird that I would think 50 years ago I would assume it's still in this area, certainly not in the last 30 years as a breeding bird. 100 years ago it was probably common here. The turtle dove has undergone a catastrophic decline. Now some of this is also related to hunting and to agricultural practices as well. The cuckoo is in big decline. You probably noticed that. Anyone heard of cuckoo this summer? If you go down the Somerset levels, you'll hear them because they are parasitizing the reed warblers in the reed beds. And if you go to Exmoor, for example, you'll hear them there because they're parasitizing the meadow crickets. But the bulk of the cuckoos that parasitize the dunnocks that are in your garden, they have disappeared because dunnocks now breed earlier because of climate change. The cuckoos arrive too late. So these sorts of changes happening. And you see here scripts in yellow wagtails also decline a lot. And here's some just local changes in southwest England. So on the left is the willow warblers, the most abundant summer migrant to the UK. It's about 25% of the summer migrant birds to the UK are willow warblers. But it's actually declined hugely in southern England, hugely in this area. And its range has simply shifted north. If you go to Scotland, it is still extremely abundant. Even in Wales, it's still very, very common. But down in the south-west and even more in the south-east, it's now quite an uncommon bird, which to me is staggering because I always think of it as the sound, the background noise of the English summer. Chenies warbler, only first pitched up in the UK in 1971. It is now widely distributed in southern England. Moved north in climate change, has probably the loudest song of any British bird. It's getting warmer and through Valley Lake on the Somerset levels, pretty much along any river, along the Severn estuary, all over the place you find them now. Just have to get our heads around the fact it's no longer a rare bird. We always thought of it as a rare bird, it no longer is. So these are the sorts of changes that are happening in very short spaces of time. So what about Beddington's perfect storm? So it's a very depressing story. Although do remember, I did point out to you that conservation does work when you do it. At least, and I've then spent some time on the threats where we haven't figured out how to get it to work. So that's where we've got to put a lot of our emphasis. But basically, we have to address all those drivers related to climate change, food security, water security, and energy, which are the drivers behind Beddington's perfect storm, if we're to get a grip of this situation for species. Beddington said, you know, because and food is probably the biggest problem, it's probably a bigger problem than climate change. This pretty little statement. The challenge for global agriculture is to grow more food on not much more land, using less water, fertilizer, and pesticides than we've historically done. There's a big debate as to whether this is actually possible. I was talking to one of my staff team who strongly disagrees with me on whether it's possible or not. My personal view is it's not possible without biotech. But anyway, we can talk about that. And these are major transformations I won't dwell on these that we're going to need to make as a society worldwide. We're going to need an energy revolution, getting our carbon emissions down, intergovernmental panel on climate change will say this is not enough by now. We need to do more than this by 2030. We need to achieve sustainable urban living. We need what I was just talking about. We need a transformation in our food systems. We need to do something about population growth. The only thing I'd say about population growth is it's a massive issue. The world's population doubled since 1960. The economy grew sixfold. So every time we think we can put the problem out on developing countries who have rapidly growing populations, we have to look at our own economic impact, which takes us back to those global footprint information I showed at the beginning of the talk. We actually have to protect, restore and sustain biodiversity, and we have to strengthen global governance, which means the systems by which we take decisions, because countries can't operate on their own on this. Too many of these issues are interconnected. The biodiversity targets, and basically the nature conservation targets, which the world agrees, are currently called the Aichi biodiversity targets, because Aichi is the place in Japan where they were agreed in 2010, are up for the renegotiation in 2020, and all the world's negotiators are kicking into gear to address this. So there's been a big push from scientists. This Georgina Mace, one of our leading conservation biologists in the UK, was first author on this paper that came out of just a few months ago, all about how to bend the curve, stop those downward lines and get the curve to bend and to go up by 7 times. So she's been going around giving every keynote speech she can at every intergovernmental conference on bending the curve, aiming higher. These are phrases she uses, and she does lots, put lots of mathematical stuff behind it to show what might be possible. And so these negotiations are, well, in fact, right now in Egypt, they are agreeing the work plan to complete the negotiations in the next 2 years. I actually work with Georgina Mace, you don't need to worry about the details here, just to come down and think what practically do we need to do to get this curve to bend. And we actually came up with five pithy little headings with targets under each. So we had space for nature and people, things like reserves. We had water for nature and people. We had legal and sustainable use of nature, and emergency action for nature, which is the one that always gets forgotten. That's what we're going to have to do with all those problems I went through that we don't have solutions for yet. We're going to have to do emergency things like Bristol Zoo is doing with its frogs. And we have to have humans in nature, because a lot of the poorest people on this planet have to live with nature, and win-win solutions have to be found there. There's also lots of other new ideas going into these negotiations coming up. And to try and deal with a problem that we haven't implemented previous targets, governments agree them and then they don't get implemented. They monitor them, they don't get implemented. Again, I don't want to go into the details here, but there's a thing called a mitigation hierarchy, which is the process which governments, corporations, etc. are supposed to go through when they're working on the impact of any project. For instance, building a road or something, you're supposed to refrain, then reduce, then restore, then redeem. You know, so people talk a lot about biodiversity offsets, but your offsets should be your last choice. You're trying to avoid damage at the beginning, etc. And so there's a lot of discussion now in relation to the global negotiations of how that thinking can be applied to decision making at all levels, from global to local, and sectoral, by a company, by a family, by an individual, by an organization, and we see how we're performing against this mindset of the mitigation hierarchy. So look, there's been a lot of detail there, perhaps too much, but to give you some idea of what's going on. I'm sorry if it's too depressing, but as Christians we have hope. So I thought this from Revelation 5 was a good one to end on. Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under earth and on the sea, and as all that is in them, singing to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, be praise and honour and glory and power forever and ever. Amen. So that's what I guess these speeches will be doing here. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that was fantastic. Thank you. So much there. As you say, a bit depressing, but we need to be challenged. We don't have a roving mic because it's broken, so we're going to try and get this one to take around to you. If I can get it switched on, and I think, any luck, that's going to work. So just hold that up against. So, yes, it is working. So, any questions? One about Labour, Chris. Give you a wait for the end.
It's not so much a question, more a sort of an observation, but being incredibly simplistic about it. If you reduce the population down to about 2 billion, you might have a chance of surviving.
Maybe. but I think we'd also have to reduce our impact. The fact is, the impact per person is going up. As I said earlier, the global economy has grown sixfold while the population has grown doubled. Now, obviously, some of that growth in the global economy was due to the population rise, but not all of it. Certainly wasn't in Western Europe. We've even had declining populations and increased standard of living. So it's not just the number of people, it's the amount of impact we have per person. In the Western world, it's much too high. It has become much too high in the emerging economies as well, especially in the Asian countries, where really there are not many very poor countries left. I've been going to India for the last 30 years, and I don't know how many of you know India. The change in India beggars belief. It's still got a lot of poverty, but nothing like what it was. That's wonderful, of course. That's something to praise God about. But all this has got to be done in a way that works with the grain of creation in the end. And we've got to find ways in which we can live and have and meet legitimate human aspirations without borrowing from the planet. That's the challenge.
With regard to all the fungal diseases that you mentioned, with the amphibians and probably with other species in some ways too, does that relate, do you think, to climate change or to chemical intervention through crops and agriculture?
There has been talk about whether the incidence of these diseases relates to climate change. Believe it or not, climate change is probably helping the amphibians because the warmer it is, the less pathogenic the fungus is. So it tends to hit at high elevations, not at low elevations. So that's sort of counterintuitive. I think what's actually happened is that these fungi have been inadvertently moved around the world. It's terribly easy to move a fungus without having any knowledge that you're doing it. In reality, the fungal diseases were moved by moving frogs and salamanders around the world. The disease affecting European salamanders almost certainly came in the pet trade, and it was almost certainly just an accident. So it's globalization, it's the movement of goods around the world has occasional byproducts. How the fungal disease got from European bats over to North American bats in the white-nosed disease, I'm not sure that anyone knows the answer to that. Because people aren't generally moving bats around. Not those sorts of bats, anyway.
Presumably trees is another example in this country.
Yeah, the trees could have come up. We've got the kind of outbreak of ash at the moment. And we lost, Duffy Island took out our big islands in our own lifetimes, right? For example, that's another example.
Charles.
Simon, do you think that ecotourism has any part to play in conservation? I'm thinking about in terms of the way the numbers of mountain gorillas in Rwanda and Uganda have been increased because of ecotourism, and maybe the same thing is happening with tigers as well in the subcontinent.
It certainly has a role to play, great livelihoods. And so ecotourism has been successfully used in parts of Africa, for sure, and in India, where ecotourism is massive, but mainly Indians. And especially in countries like Costa Rica. So the answer is yes, there's a lot of scope for ecotourism. It's not a answer to everything, because I just think too many things are too hard to see. And not that many parts of the world which don't have the creature comforts that tourists want. So I don't see Rwanda and the mountains and gorillas is probably the limit of what most tourists would expect. We're not going to be sending tourists to most of Central Africa at the moment. And large parts of Central Asia, for example, is too dangerous, or the infrastructure is just too weak. But yes, where it can be done, it can be successful.
Three related questions. What will it look like if the perfect storm happens? What will be the result? At what point will the world decide it really does have to do something? And are you hopeful?
Okay. What will happen if, no one really knows what will happen if the perfect storm hits, because we're in an uncharted territory. But I think there will be huge social and political upheaval if we got to that point. Because if we really run into massive problems of food and water supply and energy supply, that's going to have massive impacts on human livelihoods. So clearly that's going to be pretty serious. What will it take to get action? I don't know. We have problems of denial in certain political groups at the moment, as you might be aware. By and large, despite all of that, when the governments get together and decide things, their level of ambition, by and large, has been going up, not down. But that might reverse for some of these denial problems. And of course, unfortunately, some of that denial is among Christian groups. So that's something, a challenge for us, I think, to how we talk to our brothers and sisters. So that's another issue. But it's probably worth thinking about where things have been successful. Perhaps the most notable example of success was the Montreal Protocol that was brought in to deal with the ozone problem. And there were several reasons why that was successful. First of all, the causal agents, the CFCs, was very clear. And secondly, what CFCs did wasn't very nice. They basically caused melanoma, which sort of you don't want. Right? So this was enough to... and also the cost of dealing with it was relatively straightforward. The companies just had to be told, they've got a sunset clause on using these chemicals, you've got to find another way of dealing with it. And all these companies that have been saying no, they couldn't do it, of course, in the end, they could. So it was a really nasty problem, very clearly caused, and the cost of dealing with it, or, and the means of dealing with it relatively straightforward. The problem with some of these other problems, the four problems in Bevington's perfect storm, is the cost of dealing with them are going to be higher. They are more radical lifestyle changes required of all of us in how we get our food, our water, and our energy. So we're all going to have to make some sacrifices and be willing to change the way we live. And I think the general view of most politicians, left or right, to be honest, is that they, A, think we're not willing to make those sacrifices, and B, that these issues aren't top of how people vote. And they're probably right. So it's going to require some serious political leadership, and I guess it's down to us as the public and as Christians to, as it were, create that society in which politicians who by and large follow society can operate. There are quite a number of politicians who, if you talk to them, would agree with everything here, but they don't feel they can do anything, or they feel too beleaguered in their own parties, and all this sort of thing. Am I hopeful? In the sense that all Christians are hopeful, I guess, yes. Am I hopeful that, you know, I put my faith in humanity to get it right? Of course not. That God might have mercy on us? Hopefully. Then what do you think? That's not fair, sorry. Yeah.
Any more questions?
I was going to ask something. Right now in Bristol, and one actually across the UK. So does NO2, diesel, which come from diesel in particulates, we know that they affect human beings in terms of respiratory illnesses. Is that also a concern for mammal species and to further afield? Or is this just a human problem, if you like? A problem for humans?
Well, the answer is I don't know, to be honest, but it's really hard to imagine it's just humans.
Yeah,
isn't it? The problem you get on something like that is if you've got something driving the population of a species, some overriding factor, other contributing factors can be hard to detect without very detailed research. And so my guess is it isn't for most species driving the population numbers or trend, but that doesn't mean it isn't having an impact. That's not much of an answer.
Judging by the look of Bristol foxes, I think it's having quite a big effect. Some of them look pretty mangy.
Yeah, probably not.
So Tina is going to say a big thank you. I think they'll go on a bit.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. As you know, Andrew brought up this series, and I just feel this is our inflection point, maybe, that we've heard from all the different oceans and seas and air, and I think we're all pretty much, oh my goodness, So next time we're going to look at agriculture, and then we're going to look at, energy and how we do our energy. I just wanted to give just a bit of a sign of hope, if you like. In Bristol, the City Council has now voted to try and implement carbon neutral by 2030. So, and that job, when he's just passed that job, has been given to Bristol Green Council Partnership, which I'm one of the directors now. So watch this space. We're doing a campaign on clean air. There's lots of ways to get involved. So I think Bristol for City, you know, I'm hoping that there's a real will in Bristol to lead the way and really take it seriously, take it to heart, actually do, go do. So there is hope in Bristol. I think there's a very strong community here who are really quite willing to make sacrifices if they're told which sacrifices to make. But we just... I'm taking a lot of appreciation.